Wakanda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
So welcome to my podcast again. I am Conda Mason, and the name of my podcast is The Brown Rice Hour, where we have very interesting conversations, I think, at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. And I've been fortunate to have beautiful guests join me on my podcast. And today is a very special day that we have with us today, my dear teacher, friend, colleague, Tanisara, who is a Dharma teacher. She is the co-author of several books, of a couple of books with her partner, Kittisaro. She is the co-founder of the Dharmagiri Center of Buddhism in South Africa. And now they are here in California at the Sacred Mountain Sangha, that they've created the Sacred Mountain Sangha in California. So Tanisara is absolutely one of my favorite teachers, Buddhist teachers. And I just want to welcome you and thank you for joining us today,
Tanisara. Thank you. Thank you, Conda. I'm so honored to be on your show and to join you today. And I've just loved working with you and the things that we've done together, and knowing the extraordinary work that you're doing. And you're so inspirational and such a leader and influencer that is forging this, you know, the paths that you're forging, that which I'm also very inspired by and informed by. So it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, that's so interesting that it's reciprocal, because I just think it's a one-way street of my receiving from you. And you have been such an inspiration for me, particularly as a Dharma student. You gave me, well, we'll get into it, but you gave me permission. Not that I really needed it, because I am who I am, but you have modeled what it means to be a Buddhist teacher, a Buddhist practitioner, and be deeply involved in the world's issues that need to be addressed. And so I just honor you so much for your leadership. And so, yeah, thank you, really. And I want to read a little bio on Tanisara, who is originally from London, which you could probably hear the accent. And she was a Buddhist nun for 12 years in the Thai Forest School of Ajahn Chah, and was taught meditation and has taught meditation retreats internationally with her partner, who I mentioned earlier, Kittisaro, for 30 years, who I just love, and I want to get him also on this show. I probably should have done this together, but anyway, next time. Together, Tanisara and Kittisaro, they founded the Dharmagiri Sacred Mountain Retreat in the year 2000 in South Africa. And they co-founded several community HIV/AIDS response projects in the rural KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. With Kittisaro, she also co-authored a book called Listening to the Heart, A Contemplative Guide to Engage Buddhism, which we'll talk about when we get into the heart of the show. She is also the author of Time to Stand Up, A Buddhist Manifesto for Our Earth. That book had such an impact on me, Tanisara, and we'll talk about that as well. And the poetry books also, she's the author of Garden of the Midnight Rosary and The Heart of the Bitter Almond Hedge Sutra. So Tanisara and Kittisaro recently launched their Sacred Mountain Sangha. It's a California-based nonprofit that facilitates classes and courses, events, and including the two-year Dharmapala training, which I really want to take. Tanisara is a climate activist and co-founder of PAN, People's Alliance for Earth Action Now, P-A-E-A-N, People's Alliance for Earth Action Now. an initiative in response to the failure of COP26. She has also practiced the Kuan Yin Dharmas, informed by the teachings of Master Wu. Master Hua for over 40 years and is in service to Pachamama, the living spirit of Mother Nature, Godmother Earth. Oh my gosh. It is so rich. I can't wait to dive in and for our audience to hear who you are and all that you bring. So again, a deep, deep welcome. And, we start out by honoring, you know, the sacredness of the land that we are on, and by also honoring the indigenous native people whose land we sit upon. So I'd love for you to begin and let us know where you're calling in from and whose land are you calling in from?
Yeah, so, well, we're quite new to this area. So we did some research, and this is the lands of the, it intersects between the Pomo people and the coastal Miwok peoples. And it's geographically in the colonized world called Sebastopol in Northern California, which of course is very near Russian River. There's a lot of Russian immigrants here, so hence the name Sebastopol. And I've been quite tracking the local indigenous peoples that I've had a connection with through activist work, and got to hear about the Sogoria Te Land Trust, which is a rematriation of land back, but you can actually pay taxes for being on, and that's something that's spreading out across the US. So people can locally look up how to remunerate and you know, offer reparations through assessing a tax through their systems that they have in place to offer that back. So yeah, so I'm, you know, I'm aware that and contemplated a lot. I contemplate a lot just what this land would have been before it was settled, colonized, invaded, industrialized, you know. And it's, of course, something that's hard to really imagine because it's been so changed.
Yeah.
But so you do different. Get pockets of it. So you just
realize. And you feel it. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize that the coastal Miwok went that far north of.
We're a little bit above the coastal Miwok into the Pomo landscape, but we're in this slightly nuanced area where they kind of, there's a sort of space in between that seems to not have really been defined with any particular indigenous, you know, claim. But actually, the two intersect in that space,
right at Sebastopol. Mm. Thank you. Yeah, and thank you for, you know, doing the work to really understand really what's going on there, happened there. I am calling in from an area of the land of the Choctaw people who were this. This land, the colonized land, is called Louisiana, and I'm in the middle of Louisiana, Alexandria, and I'm in a parish, what they call parishes here. I'm in a parish that where the Choctaw are actually today more congregated, and where the center of the heartbeat of the Choctaw people still lives. So I'm happy to know that, and we have... this too, I'm on a 3,600 acre organic farm here. I'm looking out right now at this beautiful land. And I also always think about what did it look like? What was it like when they were really stewarding this land? And what we're doing right now is trying to steward it back as best as we can by having an organic farm, by getting rid of the chemicals and the kind of destruction that took place for many years, because this was a former plantation. Wow. So I'm on a former plantation.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really quite the depth of this land is hard for me to imagine, and at the same time, it comes up all the time. And right. And I know that my ancestors got me here because I never would have lived on a plantation in Louisiana.
You got chills when you say that.
Yeah, I was like, Tanisra, I don't know. It's like everybody says, how did you leave Oakley, California, and end up in a plantation in Louisiana? And all I can say is, ancestors,
they have their power.
They do. And I think they even are talking about it. I really think that they're more powerful right now than ever, than in my lifetime. I have been able to connect and listen and hear and understand that my duty is their vision.
Beautiful.
And that is where I am. That's what I lean back and rest in when I don't know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. I know that that is their vision that's coming through me. And so here I am on this land. Cool. Yeah. So thank you for that. And I just like to open up that sacred space and think about all of our ancestors, you know, that preceded us and that, you know, the stories of their lives, you know, whether on this North American continent, some were formerly enslaved people, others were enslavers. There's so much history here. And no matter where you are in the world, your ancestors are who you are, your blood and your bone, and really honoring that you carry that. And we carry out the duty to make life better than as best as we can, I believe. And so the work that we're doing today is really, I think, centered around our ancestors whispering or screaming in our ears what the path is forward. And then I think about those who are coming behind us, that we will be the ancestors, and may we do the work to be good ancestors. That's also a real important piece of the vision.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, I asked my first question. It sounds a little random, but it has to do with the fact that food is, I'm on a farm. I'm a farmer and I'm trying to be a farmer. I want to grow up and be a farmer. I'm learning. It's a hard job, but food, I'm a foodie, and it's changed my life as a vegan and getting, you know, stop eating meat at 19. I changed my diet at 1975. I stopped eating meat and dairy and all that stuff. And I got into microbiotics, and anyway, hence the Brown Rice Hour,
nice.
Which changed my life. Right.
Fantastic.
And so I think that food tells a story. It tells a story of our society and of our own personal history, and as well as the socioeconomics that were going on. So I like to ask this question to get a sense of where you come from. And who you come from. And the question that I ask is, what was the comfort food that you ate as a child? What was it, and who prepared it? And so that just gets us started and gives us a little window into who you are.
Great question. I grew up in an extended Irish family in West London, and they had come over from Dublin around the Second World War. For various reasons, mostly economic. And my father, who came from the really, they were considered the worst slums of Europe, the tenements of Dublin. He married my mother, who was actually English. Mm-hmm. And her family came from the East End of London, which is known as a very deeply working class, particular kind of culture. So I grew up in this very, very, you know, emergent, deeply working class roots, but emerging, trying to, you know, economically improve themselves. And so food was something that was very important, because, of course, as I go through the ancestor work and through my Irish lineages in particular, they went through extreme famine. Brought on by colonization. So there's a very ancestral memory around that. So food was there to be eaten, you know, and you did not leave the table until that was done. And I was a very fussy eater. And partly because actually, when I was very young, I became 14, I became a vegetarian, which was completely unheard of.
Wow.
After reading a book in the library on yoga in India. And I think that was more karmic than ancestral. But so I was always very fussy, but my comfort foods were my mother and my grandmother, my English grandmother was she was a real sweetie and she was a professional cook. Her job was she was a school cook, but she was so good at it that she actually in the end created recipes for over 1,000 schools. And so she was an exemplary cook, all self-taught. She was what they called in service growing up. You know, my father left school at 14. They left school. No one went to university. No one. That was completely out of our sphere. Mm-hmm. So she was self-taught, but she sort of went up the ranks through her cooking. Hmm. And she was a great pastry cook in particular, which is a very particular thing. So, you know, she had made beautiful pies and pastry pies. And, you know, those were my favorites. But particularly, I think my biggest favorite was beans on toast.
Beans on toast.
Beans on toast. And I still I still go to beans on toast when I'm sort of in need of comfort. The Irish side were less, you know, they would like have these boil these pieces of, you know, my Irish aunt would, you'd always, because it was an extended family, so we'd always be living in and out of each other's pocket, and we'd go over for Sunday lunch, and she'd go, I'll be sure now I've got a wonderful piece of bacon on the, you know, and she'd be boiling this bacon with, boiling the cabbage down to nout, you know, when you do this sort of modern kind of veggie cooking, vegan cooking, you kind of right. like just lightly boil, you don't even boil cabbage, you lightly, you know, whatever you do yeah. to it. They yeah. used to boil it down to the sludge, you know, and then they cook it up. And I would, at the family dinners, I would actually get this stuff and like feed it to quietly to the, because they had a children's table. So I'd feed it quietly to the dog under the, to the poodle. Under the table, their beloved poodle. So anyway, I wasn't very good at
following along on
the Irish cuisine. But, you know, my mother was a great cook and I landed up. That was one of the skills I learned. So when I came into the Buddhist world, I did a lot of cooking on retreats. That was one of the ways I could do the retreats because I didn't have the finances. So I was always cooking like for large retreats. And then I started to cook for the monks. And then in the monastery, I was a cook until I became more radicalized and decided that this fitted the patriarchal paradigm and I wasn't going to cook anymore. So
I'm not cooking for these men. So,
but I do love cooking. I do. One of the things I love to, I think it is so primal and primary.
It is. I love it too. I had no idea you were a cook. This is my first time hearing this story.
Absolutely.
We got to eat together. We have to eat.
I would love that. And I would love to learn more. But I mean, I have this thick book on macrobiotics because I admire it so much, but I've never been able to really cook that. But I have really, the diet of macrobiotics is one of the best, Ayurvedic and macrobiotic is the best diets that I've come across, macrobiotic in particular. It's incredible.
It was incredible. It was way early. Like I said, it was in the 1970s. And what was his name? Michio, what was his name? Who did the macrobi? I can't even think
of
his name. Anyway, I was a follower and did it. It was incredible. And I'm no longer macrobiotic, but I've been vegan since then. And I never looked back.
I became a vegan about, I've been on the verge of it for years, but I finally shifted, I think about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's actually incredible. I would never, it's just so haunting for me what happens in this industrial animal farming. It's just horrific.
It's horrific.
And I just realized I didn't want anything to do with any of it. You know,
I can't participate either. It's just really, if people would educate themselves and understand what it really is, it would probably just horrify. And it's, you know, sometimes it's like, don't look, don't ask, don't tell kind of a thing. And it's unfortunate because the kinds of lack of compassion the reverse of what happens in those places to our fellow, you know, species, other species, our brothers and sister species who are just being as horrible as if they have no consciousness, no feelings, no anything, and it's not true.
Absolutely.
It's not true.
Absolutely. You know, deeply sensitive and aware and conscious with family systems and...
Family systems. Absolutely. And, you know, the cries of the mother cows, and you know, it's just horrific. And so I am too, you know, been very impacted by that and left the meat industry for many, many years ago. And I can't even imagine anything different in my life, but that's just what it is for me. Actually, Tara Brock and I have done a little podcast, a little special on that too. And we want to talk about that. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for the food conversation. I had no idea. So now you got to feed me.
I'll try and upgrade from beans on toast.
Yeah. Upgrade it a little bit. All right. And so, you know, I want to go back to talking about the Thai Buddhist tradition of Ajahn Chah. I want to start there because honestly, I have so much. I try to turn my jealousy into mudita. I so wanted to meet him and to have studied with him. And I just love talking to anyone who has had that opportunity, being in the lineage of Ajahn Chah with my teacher and mentor being Jack Kornfield and coming from that lineage. So, and you had a chance to be with him. And I really wonder what what is the biggest takeaway that you had during that time and what kind of led you there and what led you out?
Well, I met him when he first came to the UK in 1977. Mm-hmm. And at that time I was cooking on a retreat and we were sitting, you know, it was one of these early Vipassana Goenka type retreats, although it was led by a Burmese monk and we would listen to the tapes. It was in the UK and he had just arrived it was his first time to the West, and he arrived and he came to see what we were, you know, what the scene was. So he came into this retreat and we had just completed this 10-day retreat, or were nearly completed. And then my first impression, we were sitting in these old Nissan huts. They were huts that were, they were evacuee camps actually from the Second World War, where the children were evacuated to from London. And they were still up in this old Victorian house that was bought by a Burmese family that were a refugeed from the political situation around when Aung San Suu Kyi's father was assassinated in Burma. Mm-hmm. So that gives the context. Anyway, yeah. we were sitting there and it was unexpected. No one announced it. But then these two monks walked in the front of the hall. Mm-hmm. And one of them was a very tall, lanky Westerner, which was Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah's first Western disciple. And the other one was Ajahn Chah, who was small and squat and rotund. And, you know, it wasn't so much, I mean, they looked very...
Right, Mutt and Jeff. Right.
But it was the vibration, that, you know, it was like they came, it's like they had walked in from another planet. And I what I picked up was the frequency of vibration immediately. It was like, I was almost like completely kind of frozen in time, just feeling this energy. And then what Ajahn Chah first did before he said anything is that before the retreat started, we didn't really even know we were doing Buddhism, or I didn't. It was just meditation. But there was this Buddha statue. Mm-hmm. And no one's like, oh, it's just this Chinese thing, you know, whatever, Asian thing. So they stuck it in the corner. So Ajahn Chah saw this and he picked up the Buddha and he put it on the table, dusted it off, and then he bowed. He got down and he bowed. So that was his first teaching. To me, that was like seeing him bow, and I'd not seen that before. It was like, to me, I just understood thematically, this is the perfect way to be in life. Mm-hmm. So then I snuck out of the retreat and started to listen to him. And the very first talk he gave, it was translated. I just kept sitting there thinking, this is incredible. This is this you know, and I was just so filled with, you know, just, and then at the end of the talk, he said, if you've been sitting there thinking this is good or bad, you haven't been listening properly.
Good or bad.
Good or bad.
Right,
yeah,
right.
So I met Ajahn Chah a few times in that visit, and then I went to Asia and then went to Thailand to visit him there. And it was there that he suggested that I become a nun. So I went to stay with the first Western nun there, who's no longer a nun, but her name was Kung Fa. And, you know, I mean, I was 22 and I was like, okay, I'm going to now be a nun in Thailand, but I better go back and tell my mom, you know.
Good idea.
So I went back to England and just thought, I'm going to pack everything up and go off to Thailand. And so when I got back, they just started. Well, two things happened. I went to see Ajahn Chah. You know, it was like 1979. He'd come back a second time, and I went to see him again. And he said, you know, when I went to see him, why did you come back? And I'm like going, well, you know, Western calm. And he didn't seem impressed by my answer, but there was a monk helping to translate. And that turned out to be Kittisara, who's now my partner, who had this strange accent. You know, he's from Tennessee. So he was like, yeah, yo, you know. I was like, who's this guy? You know, so anyway, I mean, I had no idea. I mean, we were in the monastery sort of like, you know, along the same tracks. He was 15 years, I was 12 years. So, you know, we didn't realize we would land up in this partnership and marriage, but at that time, obviously. So the karma was already being set, but, you know, like, so Ajahn Chah, then I rang my friend who I lived in the commune at that time. We were organizing retreats and I was cooking again. I rang my friend who was Italian. It was a mixed European. And I said, you've got to come and meet this master. So I dragged her up to this place where he was staying at this Burmese sort of site, which was now a Buddhist center outside of Oxford. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of went up to his door, like this little wooden cabin that they'd had for him to live in.
Right.
And I just went bang, bang. I had no idea of monk's etiquette or just bang, 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 bang. Oh, so he opened the door, and he'd always been like this, like very gregarious and funny and engaging and dynamic. And
yeah.
And I sort of immediately had this feeling of like being in a lion's den. It was like, oh, there's a different, he looked really like quite sort of stern.
Mm.
But he invited us in, mm-hmm. and we sat down, and I was sitting in front of him, and I could feel, oh God, this does like,
this may not turn out so good.
And he said to me, what do you understand about no self and anatta? And it was translated. And of course, you know, I'd done a few meditation retreats. And so I'd read a few things and I'm like, oh, okay. So I started talking. And the more I talked, the more my sense of self and my face reddened. I could feel it like the heat. Like I felt like I was growing, you know, like, and he was getting emptier and emptier.
Right. And you were getting more self.
I know. I just petered out and I looked at this down. I thought, could I just please disappear now? You know, it's like I felt so... And he says something in Thai and they refuse to translate. And so he said it again more forcefully. And they said, you know, he says you're very ignorant. And it's like he just got this pin and went, poof. And I went, the balloon just deflating. But it felt such an honor, you know.
Wow.
It felt so. And then he gave this incredible, I don't remember the talk, but he basically was non-self. He basically was just the Dharma, you know, so he gave this transmission and, you know, basically, you know, I was just hooked on Ajahn Chah from the very first bow that I saw. I don't know. It was his, he, you know, he called it stabbing the heart. It was, you know, I hadn't, to me, he, what took me into, I mean, people say, why did you go into a monastery? It's an extreme thing to do in England at that time, because at the same time this was happening, they started the first monastery just down the road from the commune where I was in West Sussex. So I didn't need to go back to Thailand. I just went there and then I cut my hair off and there was a few other women and we began as the first nuns. But, you know, that was... there was nothing in the culture at the time. And it was a, you know, we were doing this rigorous thing, you know, like get up at 4, once a week, we'd sit all night on the moon days, eating before 12. I mean, it was like hardcore. Wow. And there was no way I would have just sauntered into that. And what preceded that, which I haven't really spoken about publicly, but I'm thinking of actually writing more about it, was my explorations through psychedelics as a teenager, mm-hmm. which completely changed the landscape for me. And that was at the end of the wave of the 60s.
Right.
You know, so I was completely unprepared for what opened up for my mm-hmm. cultural background mm-hmm. when I realized that, you know, this being wasn't really me. You know, I was just like, it was like a vehicle. And yeah. I landed up in this, you know, this transmission of like this sort of source code almost of what we're doing here in this very vast consciousness. So trying to ground that, I mean, I really was led to the monastery, and that 12-year journey through monastic life was really what was about integrating and grounding and finding a path to try and access. You know, for a long time I was trying to access that same state, but that wasn't really, that's not really been part of the, you know, part of the curriculum for me, because a lot of it was just realizing that it's a path of purification.
Like personal purification.
Yeah.
Versus.
Well, you know, just to realize that just to the heart's already that radiant, mm-hmm. timeless, mm-hmm. but what obstructs, you know, so what obstructs that direct realization. So right. monastic living is really a confrontation, mm-hmm. A direct confrontation with what obstructs, you know, and it brings yeah. that out, it forces that's the right. issue. Well, Ajahn Chah style, you know, he would go straight yeah. to that. You know, people would go to him in Thailand and they'd want lottery numbers, you know, like, do you have they call nimitta, like a vision. And if the, you know, are there any numbers in there? And they take and they go to Ajahn Chah and last little story, because I know we need to move on. And they go, you know, like, have you got any like numbers? And he'd go, yeah, I've got a nimitta, I've got a vision. He said, I see dukkha. I see dukkha in the end of dukkha. Do you see that? But when he died, the date of his death day, they mm-hmm. all in Ubon, where he was in the northeast mm-hmm. of Thailand, they all used the numbers and everyone won the lottery.
No way. The numbers of the date that he died? The day, month, and year?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. That was the numbers everyone rushed off. Number. And they bankrupted the bookies. You know, they just...
Wow.
That was very cool. The headline was the Meta of Ajahn Chah.
Oh my God, that is so interesting.
He was very powerful.
Very powerful.
He never talked about, but he clearly had a lot of psychic powers.
I mean, I never met him, obviously, and you know, many, many decades later, he's had such an influence on my life, and so and all of my Dharma siblings, and so the power of this individual, and just reading about him and the kinds of answers to questions, and you know, he was I'm so happy that you had that direct experience. That's amazing. And I, what actually made you leave? Why did you leave?
I was very, very devoted. And I didn't, you know, to tell you the truth, I was very, very uneducated as well. So I wasn't really, I didn't really have a political or socio-economic frame to filter anything through. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know the word gender, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. Wow. So I didn't even have, a gender analysis.
Right.
I was just in there thinking I was the same as everyone else, you know.
Cooking up a storm for everybody, right?
Storm. But eventually, you know, when it started to dawn on me what we would now call what a deeply patriarchal system it was.
Yeah.
And how the nuns were, you know, we were in a no man's land, really. We were, you know, the nuns to this day, unless they're full bhikkhunis, full ordination, they're not considered part of the sangha.
Right.
You know, so, and that shows up in a million different ways.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the discrepancy. And it started to actually, what happened first was I started to get sick, and it focalized around my throat. I had this cough that wouldn't go away. And then one day I realized I didn't have a voice. You know, so, and then it kind of, so it was such a deep shock for me to wake up into this, this system. It wasn't so much the Dharma or the teaching. And I remember one day sitting at the nun's cottage and feeling this 2,500-year war against women to keep women out, the deep feminine, how the, how, and I just couldn't feel how that was going to break. And it, it kind of catalyzed me and pushed me almost into a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
Which was really misunderstood. My teacher thought it was like a breakdown of my sense of self, but it was really more the impact of that. So anyway, I kind of, I started to become, I started to challenge the system in all sorts of different ways.
Uh-huh.
And
while you were a nun, while you were still.
I mean, it wasn't so much a strategy, but it was something deeper that would start to speak out, you know, and it was a voice that I realized is very ancient in me. And it came out when I was first going to Catholic Church. We were being scripted into doing confession, and I was in the priest confessional box. I was about 10, and I was reading, you know, had to read these sins that we were done. And I this fear came up. And then underneath the fear, this voice came out, which wasn't really my voice, because I was very voiceless as a kid, really. But this voice came out and just said, I'm not doing this. Oh. And I was so shocked. He was so shocked, but it was so authoritative. And it was that kind of thing that started to come out, you know. And I think in the end, I got exhausted with the struggle, because the, it became, you know, the level of sickness, you know, I felt very depressed. You know, there was just so many symptoms of oppression that came out. I didn't really have the psychological languaging for it. And also how it was very divided. It divided, you know, when you're in the subset, you know, group in a underneath a dominant group, it's actually often very divisive. Because
in that
people
group.
In that subset group, because people are finding their power relationship to the existing power structure. So the nuns could never coalesce together.
Right.
Always fracturing around this dominant power dynamic.
Right.
And so it's very impactful. But, you know, and I think really, you know, I kept trying to devote myself to the, you know, to bring about the high order nation and this and that. But when by completely unexpectedly, Kitty Sara and I kind of collided. And from friends, we very quickly felt this attraction. And the thing that you don't do in a monastery is speak about it, because that couldn't obviously like break the spell of your monastic. But we started to, and he was at a place too, I think, after doing a year solo retreat, when his affinities were like moving more kind of a little bit out of the sphere of just the alignment with Theravada. He was connecting with also the Guanyin Dharmas and a lot of opening. So as we were speaking, something started to change, you know, like alchemically with us. And, you know, we were falling in love. And for me, it was like a choice of the path, that path of relationship and love.
Yeah.
That happened very quickly.
Yeah.
And I think partly what led up to it also was a feeling of exhaustion of trying to face off against this patriarchal system.
Yeah, trying to change the system from within. You know, it's so interesting that we've not talked about this, but my also, I have two other friends who did years of being in, being nuns, Buddhist nuns, and the exact same story of the patriarchy bumping up against them realizing their own, who, you know, who they are and who they aren't, and, you know, and really bumping up against that system. And what you just spoke to about the sisterhood being fractured as people are coming up to more consciousness. And
when the nuns started to actually really coalesce after I left, after, you know, quite a few years, there's some quite powerful women, and they started to get outside therapeutic help. And they started to really coalesce and empower themselves. And as that happened, they started to explore the high ordination in tandem. But it so threatened the system, actually, that then came out under the auspices of the abbot of the time, who's still the leading teacher there, came out this sort of piece of legislation which basically crushed them. It's called the 5 points. It was a whole drama around it about 10 years ago, which I got quite engaged with. But it basically demolished the nuns' community pretty much.
Wow.
And kept it in a perpetual, perpetually doesn't allow it to evolve. Didn't allow, and also the feminine within the masculine, you know, so that you know, I think as, you know, a subordinate group starts to really organize and become, it's the threat, you know, you can see it with the race dynamic now, you know, when the level of response becomes more and more primitive.
Yep.
More and more sort of just brutish, you know, it's always been brutal, but it's so threatened. So anyway, that was a shock for many people, not so much for me because I'd lived it, you know, to realize what keeps these things in place is underneath all. Well, it's a shock because people like expect spiritualized people to be more, you know, it actually was very violent what happened. I consider it quite violent.
And it feels like when I think about your voice now, it's hard for me to imagine you not having a voice and listening to that time when you didn't, because your voice is so clear and so strong and so upfront. And that time in as a nun had to be a big part of informing of the lived experience, not just the, you know, intellectual experience of domination and subordination, but the lived experience of it and who you are and what you bring to the world. It had to be an incredible, yet hard, as those things are that we learn the most from, a real learning ground. The actual visceral lived experience to understand it so deeply, because your analysis is so deeply rooted, and I see too the connection of your lived experience of being a nun in that heavy patriarchal system. I think about I know that the next move that I know about was South Africa. And I know that in South Africa, I mean, we're looking at one of the most repressive regimes on the planet with apartheid. And then you go to South Africa. Now, I know that, you know, I think Mandela was released in 1990. I think you got there in 2000, right?
We got there in 1994.
You got there in 1994.
At the liberation. There.
Okay.
Just after the liberation. The political liberation.
I see. Okay.
First vote. The first vote was April 1994. We arrived in November 1994.
Ah, got it. So you then go, you end up in the most, you know, repressive regime on the planet at the time, it seemed, one of them anyway. I'm sure there's others that I'm not thinking about in this moment. But there you are with deep repression and you coming out of that and having a lens of spirituality in Buddhism and understanding that these kind of systems can't continue. And so the work of Dharmagiri, I guess I'm trying to get you to speak to your arc of coming to South Africa and why and how that plays into this incredible voice that you have and created, and particularly around injustice, patriarchy, all of what you speak to right now. And of course, climate is a huge one that we'll get to.
Well, it's, it's like been a 30-year nearly relationship with South Africa, a very, again, deep for cereal, is that the right word? You know, in your guts level. Mm-hmm. And, it was a complete, I knew nothing about South Africa other than the word apartheid, of course. So actually, I'm going to struggle to try and distill something so huge.
Yeah.
It felt like a heartbreak. Mm. It felt like a heartbreak. And, I think one of the affects of apartheid was seeing how much things You know, I don't know, this waitiko term is very appropriate, this sort of that which splits apart, that which sort of in very deep and strange ways that you can hardly track, and yet suddenly something that seems so cohesive and connecting, just there's a movement that happens and there's just oppositional dynamic.
Yeah.
And what I really was confronted with, because it was deep rural area, was both the extreme trauma of the Black community and the massive amount of disarray from all of the impact. It wasn't just 50 odd years of apartheid, it's several hundred years of colonialism, land displacement, migrant labor systems, extreme poverty. The people of the Zulu community were demolished, really, in terms of, not in terms of their own culture and their own way that they would then pull together, but in terms of resources and access to resources. So for me, that was that and that in relationship to a white community that had been used to having enormous privilege and entitlement. And that within that, underneath, as I started to work with the Dharma, and we started to work with the Dharma, to realize that particularly those that had been shaped and grown up in that system, there's a real way that there's a desensitization or a split between the abstracted view that you have to hold a peoples as an other to justify apartheid, and the felt lived experience, which a felt lived experience is one of intimacy with other beings. You know, so there has to be this sort of cutting off and denial of the deep sensitivity, which is what patriarchy does as well.
Right.
So, you know, how that plays out, what I experienced was a fracturing of trust. If you don't have that, if you're not allowed that deep, you know, landing in empathetic relationship with other, due to these false categorizations of gender, race, and all the rest of it that goes with it, then you can't really trust, you know. So there's this defensiveness. And what I experienced, to teach at depth, became very threatening, because it's an invitation to deconstruct those defenses. Mm-hmm. It's very threatening anyway at a certain point. So we actually found ourselves, because of that, in a very ambivalent, we were held, I think, in a very ambivalent position, and found ourselves in, you know, and also in the crux and cross waves of a community that was economically dominated by white power, but also defending itself from, you know, the book of poetry I did, The Bitter Almond Hedge, was the Bitter Almond Hedge was the hedge that the first settlers in the 1600s planted around the settlement of Cape Town to keep Africa out. You know, so there was in a way, that became internalized until it was legislated as apartheid. So the whites have this, like, keep Africa out, you know, feeling. And the fear, and underneath that, this tremendous irrational fear of being engulfed or destroyed. And in fact, it's a projection, because it's the white community that engulfed and destroyed Africa. So it's a very, you know, I know this is, you know, sort of take another whole podcast, but it's just such a complex dynamic. And for me, it became about trying to survive this and grow something that was positive and not be destroyed in the process. There were many forces that tried to destroy us.
But so who was your audience? Who was your community? Who were you? Who was your Sangha that you were going after? Was it the Black South Africans? Was it the White South Africans? Or were you trying to bring them together? What was
We actually didn't try to do anything other than be a presence and open the door and try to be, you know, in relationship and see who walked through that door. We didn't proactive. I mean, it's very complex because of the missionary. You know, whites coming in to try and sell Buddhism, you know,
Right.
So a people's already colonized by Christianity. We weren't really, it's a very delicate thing that have their own very deep Christian ancestral, you know, thing going, you know, as their spirituality. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, what started to happen is that the more mobilized, upwardly mobile middle class, often women that were leaving the African patriarchy themselves, were beginning to turn up for meditations. And now, you know some of those women that have trained at Spirit Rock, that have gone through the, you know, different...
They're white women or
black women, black, you know, black, African,
black African or white.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, that trained at CD, the community Dharma leader, and one has just gone through the IMS teacher training. So, but they're very few, you know, but our what's happening now, to fast forward, we put all the assets into a nonprofit, and we basically wanted to gift it, the whole thing of Dhammagiri, the land, all of it, which was originally in our name. We wanted to gift it all to South Africa, you know, but what's happening is that there is, you know, that the majority of our board are non-whites. But all of the people involved are, you know, they're just a different generation. They are people that have come up from the ashes of what was apartheid, and are very deeply schooled in the damage of it, and are looking for forging something else. And they're, you know, mixed racially. So,
Wow, what a! I never made it to Dhammagiri. I tried. I think, you know, a couple.
I know.
Of times.
Well, maybe one day you'll go there and teach.
I would love to.
You're welcome.
I'd love to sit. And then
you're also welcome to come and sit. There's such a powerful place.
I know.
That's it. The mountain, the Umvelini Mountain. It's, you know.
You know, I think about. I'm going to shift to where you are right now. And, you know, there's so much I want to talk about with you, and maybe it's part two, because I, you know, your books really guided me in a way that gave me faith in Buddhism. That said, this is for me, because you opened this path and this lens around patriarchy that no, you know, and all the things that you have led. I think about you, Tanisra, you and Kitasaro. It's like your retreats, you can't even get into them. They're always sold out like immediately. So all the students, you have so many of us who love how you all teach and what you're teaching, and that you are so rooted in justice and in compassion and Kuan Yin and all the many things that you bring that are strikingly different than most Theravada Buddhist retreats. It's very different. And I mean, some of the same stuff, but you know, you have a deep signature that we're driven to, that is pulling a lot of us in that direction, that we're already there and we're like, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And I think about where you sit in the position that you sit in with the other Theravada teachings and teachers. And if there is, if there's any, how do you all fit into this sangha of Theravada teachers in the West? And how do you see yourselves in that? And are you, cause you're sort of on the outside in many ways to me. Do you feel like you're on the outside?
Yes.
Or do you feel you're on the inside?
Pretty much do, in a certain way. I mean, I think there's respect and all the things you say, but I also think there's ambivalence towards us. Mm-hmm. And that's fine for me. I'm quite happy to be on the edges of... I think it's the best place to be, actually, because once you're beholden to the systems and the certain formulate ways that they... You know, there's a certain way that the transmission is very monochrome, in a certain way, you know, in terms of the fullness of not only what it actually is, but the potential of what it can be. Mm-hmm. So, and I think this is still because it's so beholden to the rational Western metaphor. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that's changing with the influx of the BIPOC community that have radically, and the LGBTQI community have sort of radically been reshaping things. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
do
but
you
I still think.
Changing? Do you feel like it's changing? Do you
oh,
feel
yeah,
like?
Yeah, I do. I yeah. do. Yes and no, you know, yes and no, because it's an edge, isn't it? Because in some ways it's changing, and in some ways the forms is perhaps changing the fuller potential of the previously marginalized communities mm-hmm. for having to some degree conform to the structures that are still fundamentally in place.
Right.
I think the structures that are in place are not up to speed enough to meet what we're facing now. You know, mm-hmm. we don't even have conversations around the, you know, this extraordinary moment of, you know, mass extinction. Right. You know, we're still going right. on as business as usual. We're still right. flying loads of people into retreats. You know, there's right. just so many conversations that we need to have. We still, right. you know, that the current philosophical shaping and psychological roots of how we got to where we got to in the insight movement, you know, it's just a little, like, sometimes it's a little boring. Yeah. You know, it's just the same tropes that, you know, and are we really investigating what is it we're facing, a possible hot war with Russia, you know?
Right. Are we being
are we
relevant?
Any near understanding what that might mean, right. you know?
And there's this tendency, I think there's this tendency to act as if the Buddha, who was so radical, that but Buddhism, as we, you know, practice it in the West, is this kind of whitewashed over kind of pablum, like, you know, just think good all the time. And I find that is not going to last. It can't survive not being engaged in the absolute of today and how it's really, and that's what you do. You bring the Dharma in front and center into how we can see the world and be a part of it right now. And as if the two things can't exist. That's how it's kind of set up, as if the two things can't exist.
Well, that's a false split that goes right to the yes. core of Theravada. And that's, you know, that's why I feel it's an incomplete, you know, that's why one thing that happened in South Africa, we had that, you know, decades to synthesize a unique kind mm-hmm. of expression that fronts and brings forth a bodhicitta non-dual, not only as an ideal, but as an actual practice.
Right.
And I think, you know, if a lot of the senior Dharma's teachers fessed up a bit more, they would all have to admit that they've gone to other teachers to get that piece outside of Theravada, of the deep non-dual piece, you know, the deep intimacy, you know, to put it non-dual, I find rather cold language, but the deep intimacy of all things, where there isn't a split between the world and the practice, but we're still left with this dinosaur of, you know, this, you know, we don't engage in the world and the politics, you know. So I think that's a phasing, that's an old meme that I think is beginning, or old stance. And I have parts of myself. I mean, I was schooled in that, so it's not that I don't have to struggle against that part of myself.
I think about you and Kirisara, like the Pied Pipers of all of us, the newer teachers, and particularly a lot of the BIPOC teachers and the white teachers who are really ready and knowing that, you know, this is what the Dharma looks like. This is what it has to look like. This is who we are. I feel it's almost like you all are the Pied Pipers, and you're opening that door, because as it's changing, you two are actually leading that change. And I'm so grateful. That's why I'm saying, you know, in the books that you've left behind, and the poetry that you, it's like the little crumbs that you continue. They're not little, they're huge crumbs. They're big bites of food. You're the cook. You're leaving big bites of food for us to digest and to.
Well, I think that, you know, like going back to Ajahn Chah, one of the things, you know, when people asked him, like, how did he become who he became? You know, his interface with the West was actually a very small part of his life, but it had a huge impact. Yeah. And he just simply said, I dared to do, you know, I dared to do. And I think that if you want to know the core transmission of Ajahn Chah, for me, that's the infusion of courage.
Courage.
To be dare to do what we need to do now, because really we're off the map.
Yeah. And I think people don't understand. And if you can give some kind of a, leave us with a toolkit of some sort of the heart, how do we keep our hearts open and base ourselves in love and compassion and fight against or be a part of, maybe it's not fight against, maybe those, and be a part of tearing down a system that needs to go.
Well, I think you named the key, which is keeping our hearts in love and open. And I feel we have to do that together because, you know, on our own, you know, the part of the correction that has to happen is this overemphasizing the individual journey of awakening.
Right.
I think that one is that that is true. You know, we have to, this is our toolkit here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's so clear that we have to have a collective holding together. So yeah. I think we have to come out of our silos and, you know, reach out because it's a very dangerous moment that we're in. And we have to remind each other and feel together how we forge that way forward. You know, we need a lot of spaces for these kinds of conversations and to have them at a deeper somatic, real truth sharing level.
Yeah.
That allows the deeper resonances and guidance to emerge as a sort of a harmonic, you know, you'll hear it.
Yeah.
And I think we can do that internally as well, you know, just to that intuitive, you know, the Ajahn Chah called it the living Dharma. The Dharma is living. Okay, we have these maps and they guide us. And I have great respect for the maps, you know, even though we're ultimately a mapless territory now as a civilization.
Yeah.
So what is going to guide us? Because a lot of these maps, you know, it's not, we can't use them because of the consciousness they were made with. So
right.
Living Dharma is the real dynamic, intuitive presence of the Prajnaparamita wisdom that's informing and speaking to us. Mm-hmm. Everything is speaking. So to hear that in tandem with us finding ways to be together, to have these more real conversations.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. You know, because for me, I feel like I understand it, but I don't know that it's understandable because the mind doesn't really deal well with paradox, you know, that something is and it isn't at the same time. And there's that paradox of this, you know, the mindfulness about accepting what is, like life as it is, accepting what is, and yet changing what is, right?
Yes.
Both of those things living at the same time. I mean, how do you speak to that?
Well, you know, the power, you know, we can see it with this focalization. The system rewards psychopathy, you know, and sociopathy that we're in. And you can see what people are doing with that level of power. We can see it with what's happening in this current war situation. And, you know, really that is covered. You're not, you know, what we have to look at is human spirit, the power of human spirit. And to actually energize that really in a much larger collective way. And we have so many divisions already internally and then in our Dharma world that somehow, you know, if we're going to focalize as a Dharma community to actually find ways to find our common ground without denying the history and the particularity of the struggles that we need to honor, you know, struggles against racism, struggles against, you know, basically the meta system is patriarchy under which all other divisions of hierarchy sit, you know, so to be on that agenda, you know, I have a lot of inspiration from the youth, younger people they don't need to read a book to get it. They get it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, as Baba Mandaza would say, you know, they're in effect the elders, many of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Baba Mandaza. So, thank you for introducing me to him.
Yeah, we must get him back more.
Yeah.
Because he really is a voice for the...
You know, that brings me to wanting to, my last question really is about People's Alliance for Earth Action Now. Can you just give us a window into...
Well, it's, you know, I've been sort of really called for quite a while to try and, you know, like, pick up and elevate a focus on the... I mean, climate is such a sort of loose umbrella, but it really is our planetary emergency, which is, you know, we've all the things that we know, all the systems that we imperialism, colonialism, racism, patriarchy, all of these systems are feeding, you know, to have to try and find a clearer voice. And after COP26, which basically the fossil fuel, you know, they're just sort of rushing back in to take control. And they made that very clear. I, you know, it just felt like the only way we're really going to fight off this extinction suicidal trajectory on it is if people rise together.
Yeah.
And the word, you know, I know in America everything gets acronyms, so I want you to find an acronym. So PEON literally is a word that means, literally means a voice is rising joyfully together. PEON of voices. But it also has, it's spelled a bit differently, but PEON also means, it's often a derogatory term for the sort of the underdogs, the working class, the, you know, let the peons.
Right.
So, but it is that those all, you know, not just the sort of frontline hardcore activists, but it is like all of us in every regular walk of life, if we can rise more and create, you know, more engaged in actions in any ways we can, you know, that will help these tipping points that we need in favor of a new story. The new story, as Barbara Mann does, the new story that we all know that we're birthing, we're trying to birth. We've all got, you know, we've all got parts of the coding of that new story.
Yeah.
So, you know, PEON is really an attempt, you know, I see that it's inspired by, you know, people like Kriti Kanko and other people that are working around forming groups, local groups, to undertake, and then within an interface of more, you know, a global network, different people working and, you know, informed and using Dharma practices, spiritual practices, checking in. So it's still very emergent. And I'm, you know, at the place of looking at developing a core team and ways that we can just tune into what's needed and what can we support and what do people want to do. I think one of the leading lines I'd like to really focus on is the plant-based. There's a plant-based treaty that's come out to really support that. And you know, to align, you know, I see it as an alliance with what, you know, it's not like recreate, we don't have to recreate the wheel here. We won't do it as well as, you know, so many groups, but how can we support those groups already going? Right. You know, how can we make alliances? And there's so much we can do as a Dharma community, actually.
And how can people find you on the web, find the PEON?
Well, our website is sacredmountainsangha.org. And it's, you know, there is a menu heading for PEON under that. And so people can just sign up. It would take us a little while to get organized, but, you know, that's happening now to try and build some foundations.
Well, there might be some people listening to the podcast who say, I want to, you know, be a part of on the ground level. I hope so. So that's sacredmountainsangha.org to find.
Yes.
You know, if we're at time, I can keep going and going and going. I'm also aware of, we both pointed to the fact that there's a war going on right now. And it's the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yes.
And I don't know when this is going to broadcast. And so, and it will have, you know, multiple broadcasts after that. So I just was wondering if you could, if we could end by you leading us into a moment of reflection, of prayer around what's happening right now. And if you feel like you can just lead us in a way to end this podcast with our hearts open to the suffering that's happening there and other places. And it would be, I'd love to end like that if you would mind.
Well, yes. I mean, war is a horrific, horrific thing that we should have delegated to the past century. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, you know, in this current brutish act of violence that is engulfing Ukraine and the Russian peoples and further afield. And there's been many leading up the wars in the Middle East that decimated the Middle East, Syria. You know, this is a sort of like last gasp of the dinosaur of patriarchy and all that goes with it. And it chooses the path of death and destruction and violence, as is the primitive way of trying to crush anything that arises that is of a freer spirit. So may we hold to this freer spirit, may we trust it and embolden it in ourselves and in each other. Hear its beautiful freer movement in our lives, and to divest ourselves from all of the scripts that we've aligned with that keep us embedded in the patriarchal systems that are rooted in such extreme historical violence. And know that this spirit that has been manifested through so many liberation leaders, informed particularly by the spirit, and talking of South Africa, Mr. Mandela, and the struggle heroes of that era, and so many around the world up until this moment on front lines, trying to stop pipelines, the First Nation peoples that have carried the spirit for thousands of years, withstanding the worst brutalities of colonialism. We give thanks and we honor also our own ancestors that have stood up in so many ways to try and hold this free spirit against horrific forces of oppression and violence. This is a power in and of itself. May we hold to this power. May we honor it wherever it manifests in this world, in ourselves, in the children, in the grandparents, in peoples everywhere, in the plants and the trees, in the free-flowing oceans and rivers and streams. May all spirit, may all hearts be touched and infused with the power of love, knowing at depth that love is really feeling and being with the extraordinary, magical interbeing of everything in this sacred web of life, knowing that we are connected in a cosmology of mystery and radiance at its core, this great conscious knowing, present awareness resident in the hearts of all and resident within our hearts. May all be awakened within this heart. May all that hold the path of fear and oppression and violence, may they also be freed. May all return to their original nature. May we all know peace, love, strength, courage, presence, and may that liberate all beings now and always. Namo Guan Shiryen Pusa. Namo Amita Buddha, Namo Sakyamuni Buddha, Namo all beings everywhere, through time, through space.
Ashe, ashe, ashe. I can't thank you enough.
You're so welcome, Konda. I'm glad we got to do this today.
Me too. I needed this. I needed you. I needed us. I needed this. And, you know, it's for everybody else, but it's for me as well. Thank you. Thank you, Tanisara.